Hello and happy holidays. I'm Matt Wells, and this is a special edition of Media Talk. Coming up, remember this?
Why did that come across the screen?
Because you know what you're talking about.
Now, when you were
He fucked your granddaughter up!
In terms of Channel 4's ability to invest in radio as a venture at this time, it's just proved impossible to justify the short-term investment.
Right, well, I'd like to say that I'm delighted with that judgment, which is devastating for the news of the world. Their Nazi lie was completely invented.
Hey, ain't you forgetting something?
Mwah. We look back on 2008's biggest stories from the worlds of radio, TV, print, advertising and online. There's Manuel Gate, the end of Channel 4 radio, Max Mosley taking on the news of the world, and that Heinz gay kiss advert. Plus, we'll gaze into our crystal ball and analyse the prospects for the media industry in the coming 12 months. There's a recession on, don't you know? Grab yourself a mince pie and pour Grandma another glass of cherry brandy. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Merry Winterville, listeners, and welcome to this special edition of the weekly media podcast that's much better than the other one. Joining me in the grotto and playing the part of Santa's little helper is The Guardian's Director of Digital Content, Emily Bell. Did you have the best Christmas ever, Emily?
Oh, I can't imagine how good it was.
Well, we've got plenty to get through in our review of 2008. Let's start with unquestionably the biggest story of the year, where a couple of naughty answer phone messages created a national outrage. It led to the resignation of one of Britain's finest comedians, the suspension of the country's best-paid presenter from his £6 million a year contract, and Radio 2's much-loved controller to fall mightily on her sword. We'll hear from our radio correspondent in a moment, but first let's remind ourselves how the whole sorry mess unfurled.
"5,000 complaints.
10,000 people.
Look, Andrew Sachs, I've got respect for you and your lineage and progeny. Never let that be questioned.
Don't hint.
I wasn't hinting. Why did that come across as a hint?
Because you know what you're talking about.
Now, when you were
he
doing...
He fucked your granddaughter.
Ofcom.
BBC Guidelines.
Where is the Director General, Mark Thompson?
Who gave permission for that broadcast to go out?
I think they should be punished. I think they should have their jobs taken away.
Completely unacceptable.
18,000 complaints. Recorded program.
Gross lapse of taste.
Severe offence.
He said, would you like to do the whole thing again next week if you're free? I said, that's a good idea.
John Plunkett, radio correspondent for Media Guardian. It was undoubtedly the big radio story of the year. Yes, a Saturday night Radio 2 show, which 300,000 odd people listened to every week and didn't get too much attention. And then suddenly a couple of answer machine messages to Andrew Sachs from Russell Brand and Jonathan Ross. And suddenly the whole country is talking about it and 40,000 people are complaining to the BBC. And it ended, of course, with Russell Brand resigning, with Jonathan Ross being suspended for 12 weeks. And the most important casualty from a media industry point of view was, of course, Leslie Douglas, who was talked about as a future director of radio and is now, of course, over at Universal Music, her career taken entirely unforeseen direction.
She believed that Russell was an important symbol. But
did she let him get away with, you know, far too much? That's basically it, isn't it?
There's no question about it. You know, I can try and be evasive and clever and come up with euphemisms, but the fact is that he was her pet. And she let him get away with so many outrageous things. I knew this would end in tears because it could only end in tears. When you pick up a time bomb, one day it will explode because that's what time bombs do.
When Leslie Douglas quit, some people were surprised that she went so quickly. But when the findings of the BBC Trust report came out, it became clear why she took that decision. Most importantly, there was the infamous one-word email which she sent from her BlackBerry, approving broadcast of the Russell Brand show, in which she just said yes to a list of questions and issues which have been put to her by Dave Barber, the Radio 2 executive in charge of compliance, who also quit. But it makes you think, certainly looking back, that that broadcast required perhaps a longer response and maybe slightly more dialogue than a single word.
This is Channel 4 Radio.
DAB, which of course no one needs reminding is... hang on, no, I've got it here somewhere. Oh yes, no, digital audio broadcasting, which at the start of the year wasn't entirely rosy, but we were still looking forward to Channel 4 launching with their radio stations and also a host of other radio stations such as Closer from Bauer Radio on the second, the catchily titled second national commercial digital radio multiplex, or 4Digital if you prefer. But come October, it was expected, but still came as a mortal blow to the hopes of DAB Radio when Channel 4 pulled the plug. And 4Digital still lumbers on, but we expect the license to be returned or taken back by Ofcom at the start of the year. So it doesn't mean to say that digital radio is entirely in the doldrums, because it's nearly one in five radio listening hours is via digital radio, about 18-19%. And of course, DAB isn't the only way you can listen to digital radio. You can hear it via your digital TV or online. But certainly the industry needs DAB to succeed, and the industry needs to find a way, certainly the commercial sector needs to find a way of making DAB pay.
On DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV.
So looking ahead to 2009, I think there are opportunities for commercial radio, because the BBC is perhaps weaker than it has been for some time in radio. We've got a new director of audio music in Tim Davey, who has no previous radio experience, although he's on a steep learning curve after the Douglas affair. There is no controller in charge of Radio 2 yet, a vacancy to be filled. There's a relatively new controller in charge of BBC Radio 5 Live in Adrian Van Claveren, and also he has to oversee the move of the station from London to Salford, which won't happen until 2011, but clearly preparations have to be put in place now. So the good news for commercial radio is that BBC Radio is perhaps weak, and perhaps it can peg back the BBC in the ratings war. The bad news, of course, for commercial radio is that with the economic downturn, commercial's rarely been in such a weak position to make the most of the BBC's relative weakness here. But there are opportunities. The question is, can commercial take it?
So, Emily, what the Jonathan Ross was all that about?
Goodness knows, we kicked through the ashes of that one at the time. It was actually, I thought the bit that we missed was the when we said suddenly there were 40,000 people complaining. There was actually 11 days, and the Daily Mail standing by the dying embers of this story with a massive pair of bellows going, trying to breathe some sort of life into the scandal, the non-existent scandal. But it was one of those moments where, unfortunately, there were a collision of sorry circumstances, including a bit of kind of a hole in compliance and editorial procedure. And as the result of it, my Saturday nights have been ruined. There's nothing for me to listen to at 9 o'clock, certainly not on Radio 2.
I do quite like. Well, I have been enjoying the Saturday morning offering of Danny Baker.
No, Danny Baker is brilliant. Somebody else other than Danny did it the first Saturday that Jonathan Ross was suspended, and I listened to it for about 20 minutes, during which the presenter, who's clearly trying very hard to be uncontroversial, said that we've had text in from someone who says he's run over an umbrella on his way to the market in South Wales, and he just thought, this is why you're paying.
Yes.
So much money. So no, it was from my point of view, it's sad to lose Russell Brand from the airwaves. And I was moving his picture from my office into the new building just before Christmas, and I wrapped it in the Daily Mail, which I thought was a fitting tribute.
Very fitting tribute. And did all that have anything to do with the fact that Jenny Abramsky was replaced by Tim Davey?
No, I think the incident would have happened anyway. But yeah, I think it exposed why you need strong editorial leadership at the top of organisations which are all about editorial content.
Mm. Quick word on Channel 4 Radio. Do you think is digital audio broadcasting dead, or...
Well, no, because Santa Thompson, as we know, as we now like to know Mark, the Director General of the BBC, sort of come around with a sack full of money and pulled it down DAB's chimney, if that's not a metaphor too far.
It's very good.
So I think that it will limp along for a while longer yet.
Because, a transitional technology, you think, perhaps?
Well, it is a transitional technology, and I think that there are businesses that need it, and equally there are businesses which are sort of hobbled by it, and really what needs to happen is the public purse, or the BBC, whatever you want to call it, should take up the slack from the people who are finding it very hard to sort of deal with this commercial sector. And, you know, it will need to be sustained, I think, sort of, you know, until we've got a portable alternative. And internet radio is nearly there, but it's not quite there yet.
Media talk from guardian.co.uk.
Aside from the unprecedented 3-month suspension of Jonathan Ross, it's been a topsy-turvy 12 months for the television industry. For ITV's share price, it's been a case of, to quote status quo, down, down, deeper and down. Meanwhile, when it came to public funding, Channel 4 has been asking, please, sir, can we have some more? On top of all of this, Newsnight's Jeremy Paxman thought it was more appropriate to cover Strictly Come Dancing than genocide in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Seemed like a good idea at the time, eh, Paxo? Anyway, this was definitely the year in which the airwaves went blue. Here are the thoughts of Janine Gibson, former editor-in-chief of Media Guardian and newly appointed editor of Guardian.co.uk. Either way, she's a very grand fromage.
Yes, well, it's been a terrible year for profanity and our reaction to it.
This hour run my fucking restaurant, it's not true!
That's why you're in this shit, you
no,
fucking fat idiot!
Don't call me fat. You are a twat. Do you know that?
You stupid,
stupid, fucking silly looking.
Now, were we cultural commentators, we might observe that, you know, in straitened times, hemlines go down and therefore one's attitude to the frivolous and obviously completely unacceptable changes. Certainly the outraged camp are able to get so much more outraged about things that probably last year we wouldn't really have taken much notice of.
Not enough consideration is given to a very large section of the audience who perhaps don't want to hear such words. You therefore have to know why you're using it and give it a little bit of extra consideration.
This idea, and it comes from America, that the sort of broadcasting metropolitan elite have become detached from the values of the rest of the populace, which, of course, in the case of the BBC, pays their wages, has become quite prevalent now and has really taken hold. And it has changed the game for people in entertainment and live broadcasters.
This is Channel 4.
Structurally, the game's completely changed for Channel 4. It's almost unimaginable that they will escape privatisation now. I think when you talk to people in government, when you talk to people in regulation, and when you talk to sort of think tank type people, all of whom were a consensus against privatisation and believed quite fundamentally that Channel 4's role as the sort of keep the BBC honest public service alternative was so crucial to the dynamic and the fabric of British broadcasting, that's all dissipated, and everybody seems to now feel that privatisation is the only solution. Partly, Channel 4 raised this issue themselves by saying, clearly we have a funding gap and how are we going to sustain ourselves? And partly they have brought it on themselves through some slightly reckless investing in radio and in 4IP. Projects which seem good in times of plenty now look ridiculous and like a complete waste of money, which ought to be funneled back at core services. And it highlights again the difference between broadcasting and the rest of the world, that everybody else is retrenching, focusing back on the core, pulling back, and Channel 4, they're almost like buy-to-let landlords. You know, they suddenly bought a whole bunch of risky properties to try and capitalise on a boom just at the moment where the market collapsed.
Available to watch now at bbc.co.uk/iPlayer. BBC iPlayer, making the unmissable unmissable.
Well, I genuinely believe that the iPlayer is transformative technology, and the fact it's not unique technology, that's really important. The way it's been presented and the effort that has gone into selling it to the public as a way of watching television programmes and long-form video on the internet has been so completely dominant in the idea of watching video online that the only option now really for us as licence fee payers is for the BBC to open it up. That argument is slowly starting to be had, which of course at the beginning of the year they were nowhere close to having it. As a service to British viewers, whether they are, you know, licence fee payers or expats or whatever, it is a citizenship bonus to have the iPlayer, and it just needs to be opened up.
We're here with Senator Barack Obama.
My favourite programmes of the year have been slightly eclectic, I think. The Daily Show, because of the US election, was just completely compulsive, and it's quite easy to forget it's there a lot of the time, but for a good 3 months there, it was absolutely required viewing.
With the experiencing thing, have you thought about running a smaller country first?
No, you know, what I did think about, though, was invading a smaller country. As, you know,
great way to get some popularity.
Doctor Who continues to be great, but my absolute favourite programme of the year is a show called Outnumbered, which everybody missed on its first run.
Give it now!
No.
Who are you two?
She started it.
I haven't even asked who started
it.
What's going on?
She said word. Called me Leza, which I don't like. He called me Leza, which I really don't like. And a toss piece. And
when was the last time a sitcom in prime time on BBC One made you laugh out loud?
Janine Gibson there. Let's pick up from where she left off and look at a few of the other issues in the TV industry this year. We didn't talk with Janine about ITV and Sky's stake in ITV, but that was a very interesting development.
Yes, this was the stake in ITV taken by Sky, which effectively blocked any takeover by Virgin of ITV, but it was ruled to be anti-competitive, even though it was not against the law. So they have to now sell that, I think. We're up to date now, aren't we? But it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because now when you think about it, when one sort of, you know, looks at all of that in retrospect, that also seemed to come from a kind of a different time, whereas now, you know, barely a year later, you've got Sky and Virgin making friends and sharing their toys and opening up their platform to one another, and poor old ITV with his share price lower than a snake's belly, and just failing to attract bidders as yet, and looking sort of emaciated and slightly weakened.
Well, the thing with ITV, it looks corporately emaciated and weakened, but it does look, I have to say, and I've not said this for a long time, but it does look creatively quite strong now with Peter Finch at the helm. And one wonders when all the shows that he's commissioned come through next year, plus Coronation Street, X Factor, and all the other great stuff that they have.
You've got in Peter Finchman now, Elaine Bedell's gone over to be their head of entertainment, so potentially a very strong team in the core where ITV needs to be good, which is, you know, heartland mainstream entertainment.
So it could be 2009, could be creatively a very good year, but corporately really bad.
I think it could be an absolutely stunning year for ITV in terms of on the screen, and I don't think it'll make a jot of difference to the share price, because it's going to have such a lousy time commercially that it is still looking for a bid, and actually it still needs a home. It can't really survive, I think, in its current state of being a sort of a single asset, single media asset, which is meant to have a sustainable future as a commercial play. And that's the same for everybody. Same for Channel 4, same for, you know, soulless newspapers not protected by trusts, etc.
Yes. Favourite TV show of the year? Apprentice?
Well, I did quite like The Apprentice. Probably not my favourite of the year. My favourite of the year is 30 Rock, obviously, which is, you know, as in the Christmas season, Channel 5, God love them, put them back from the beginning of Series 1, post-pub slot, but never mind. So that was the imports were my favourite.
When you rock in at
homegrown.
11, Emily.
Yeah, exactly. So very old.
Drunkenly through the door.
Exactly. Post-pub at 11:30, you know, what sort of pubs they go to? Clearly not Friends of the Lock-In. In terms of homegrown telly, I was actually on the reality front. I'm a celeb. So I'm a celeb-tastic. Very much enjoyed that this year. Great show. X Factor, I still watch that. Strictly was a very, very good year for Strictly this year.
Very good year for Strictly.
All of that. I think sort of serious telly.
Can't remember much of a serious television.
Well, no, Channel 4. I thought, Ginny, it's slightly unfair on Channel 4. I thought they did have some really sort of strong programmes this year, and I thought that some of their, again, their kind of popular factuals have been really, really good this year. We had, you know, kind of the series on terrorism on BBC Two. Yeah. That was very good. I like that.
Yes, just we watch too much fluff, don't we?
My brain's actually been rotted.
Let's hope the editor's not listening. I vote for a Nick and Margaret spin-off from the Apprentice for 2009. That's what I'd like to see. Give them their own show.
Wouldn't be much of a long runner, I think. They could do with a rest.
All right, plenty more about all of this on mediaguardian.co.uk. Two down, only three sectors to go. A definite strand that's run through both our telly and radio reviews has been what medical professionals call Daily Mail itis. Paul Dacre's moral outrage has certainly helped set the cultural agenda, at least for the last quarter of 2008. Media Guardian's press correspondent Stephen Brooke has been on a shamefully long but fully deserved break in Australia for the last few weeks, so we couldn't get him. So, Emily, perhaps you can help us through an eventful year in print land. I mean, let's start.
Not
with,
my area.
It'll just have to be for this moment. Let's start with the Mail, and it has been the Daily Mail's year, hasn't it?
It's always the Daily Mail's year, but never so much as when there is a bit of a national crisis on that they can exploit, and they can terrify people into being outraged about all sorts of things that are essentially not very important. So yes, they've been absolutely...
It shows that they still have the finger of the pulse on the moral agenda of Middle England, don't they?
No, absolutely, and I think that they are one of the organisations that can really take a campaign by the scruff of the neck, and apps, whether it's plastic bags or getting rid of, you know, Jonathan Ross, Russell Brand / the BBC, which is, you know, they've all been all about rage at the BBC this year, which is partly about their failure to offload things like their regional newspapers and the fact that, you know, the BBC is now sort of competitor to all of us, and they're kind of, they've shown, they're, the Mail have shown their teeth on it. And Dacre's fantastic speech, when I say fantastic, I don't mean it will go down in the annals of journalism. it was really memorable, his speech to the Society of Editors, where he talked about...
Huffed and puffed
about Max Mosley's spanked bottom and why this was incredibly important that he could write about these things, not just because it was about the freedom of the press, but it was also about muckraking so he could sell more copies, which was a kind of a rare moment of... candor from a tabloid editor.
Well, absolutely. Well, you mentioned the Max Mosley thing. Interesting that Max Mosley won his privacy case against the News of the World with the judge ruling eventually that the News of the World shouldn't have revealed his spanking exploits.
No, that's right. And, you know, again, there was much kind of outrage in the... there's much binding in the marshes of the Daily Mail about...
Is that something to do with bondage?
I would like to think so. As I say, so Paul Dacre's back door was being kicked down in terms of privacy. This idea.
What might be happening there?
Well, it's a slightly sort of silly kind of grinding by Dacre and Co. about how this has introduced privacy by the back door. Actually, the truth is, and we discussed it at length on the podcast, it's been coming and it's been there for a long time. And actually, if you want to reveal the private habits of people who have every reason to believe that they should be protected, you're going to find it much harder in the future to make a living out of... you know, the sort of people at swingers parties, etc. Well, F1 bosses having their bottoms spanked.
I'm sure we'll find a way around it. Other notable campaigns, of course, were the Baby P story in The Sun, the record payout to the McCanns, front page apology from the Express Group to them, drew a line under that in March. Let's move on a bit. Murdoch finally got the Wall Street Journal.
He finally got the Wall Street Journal. Something very interesting has happened this year, which was being talked about in December on a lot of journalism blogs, kicked off by our own Jeff Jarvis, actually, who said Rupert Murdoch now in America is the guardian of journalistic quality because he's the only press proprietor who's really investing in journalism. And he finally got the Journal, mainly because actually the paper business was in such a state and the dividends at Dow Jones were so low that the Bancroft family, having said we will never sell, all started to think, oh, hang on a second, it's sell the Journal or yes, or give up your country club membership and your, you know, four times a year holidays in
the hotels. Sell.
Yeah. And so Rupert's installed with his gang from London, actually.
Absolutely. While there were jobs for the boys across the pond, there were job cuts across the board here, of course, with the credit crunch, the Independent looking, you know, especially vulnerable. Do you want to revise or go back on your famous prediction? How many titles are we going to go under?
Well, I actually said four or five, and it came back as a hardened up five. But, okay. You know, I did it on a kind of a 20 to 25% of the market would disappear over the next year. No,
it's starting to look conservative.
Exactly. I was going to say, I think if we get away with that, we'll be doing quite well, actually. I think that, you know, the Independent looks a bit rocky. I think the Express titles are still run for profit, and one's got to question how much profit there will be. I think that the Telegraph is lonely on its own, and I think that the Mail, the News International titles, and the Guardian, because we're obviously owned by a trust, I think we're in a slightly different place. But I think the rest of the market, Trinity Mirror, has to return money to, or has to sort of, you know, show profits and rises for shareholders. These are all really sort of troubled institutions at the moment. And do you know what? Nobody's buying newspapers.
Well,
nobody.
Keep up with media bankruptcy news at mediaguardian.co.uk. Now, if the programmes are rubbish, there's always the hope that the ads will be better. The credit crunch hit the entire advertising sector hard this year, and the prospects for 2009 are sadly looking just as grim. With all this gloom, there were a few gems, as well as a couple of real stinkers too. And as Media Guardian's advertising correspondent Mark Sweeney explains, in 2008, the ad industry has been a real bellwether for the economy as a whole.
It has, but what we're really going to see is in 2009, you're going to see layoffs and job cuts. You've got people like Publicis and WPP who have instituted hiring freezes, pay freezes. I think Sorrel, actually, an internal note came through from Sorrel to WPP saying that revenues were not in line with headcounts. Keep the headcounts down. I think there's a follow-on effect. You're hearing that marketers are going to be pulling budgets. You're reading about it in things like the Bellwether Report, and that will hit the bottom line of the ad agencies themselves. Next year, probably first quarter, you'll start to see job cuts.
Hey, lad, is it past your bedtime? time.
It's been a tricky one. I mean, following on from last year, where there were, you know, obvious ads, things like Gorilla, which really took the world by storm, or Skoda's Cake, I think that was also 2007. 2008 doesn't appear on the surface to have had lots of brilliant ads. One that does come to mind is the Hovis ad, the 120-odd second ad rounding up the history of Hovis. That got a lot of buzz around it and is seen as probably one of the better ads of the year.
I never think about yesterday.
The only day that matters is today.
Start today with Gillette Fusion Power and the confidence you get from Gillette's most comfortable shave.
The clangor of the year has gone to the Gillette ad, Federer, Henri and Tiger Woods. An extremely wooden, non-gel of a scene of these three stars. There's a bunch of other interesting ones in there. DFS's horrible lip-syncing ad to Nickelback's Rockstar song.
The DFS sale.
I want a brand new house on an episode of Cribs and a bathroom I can play baseball.
Kerry Katona is usually wooden spoon territory.
Now, where are the mini hot dogs, Kerry?
They're behind you!
Party like a celeb with Iceland.
Ham salad, please, Mum.
Yeah, you got it, kid.
Well, the Heinz Gay Kiss ad, the ad itself was only planned to run in the UK. It only ever ran here. But it got picked up in the US, and Heinz, being a big US traditional corporation, got a lot of lobbying and a lot of pressure from groups, including a right-wing Christian group, that it promoted gay lifestyles and gay marriage.
See you tonight, love.
Hey, ain't you forgetting something?
Mwah. The ad subsequently got a 200-odd complaints to the UK advertising watchdog. It had been decided that it wouldn't run, but it was actually cleared in the end.
I pity you, fool! You a disgrace to the man race! It's time to run like a real man!
Mr. T had another ad where he was accused of being homophobic for firing off Snickers bars at a man dressed in speed walking and being effeminate.
Well, my pad is very messy, and there's whiskers on my chin.
The sensitive souls here in Britain, the most complained about ad looks almost certain to be one for Volkswagen, featuring a small fox terrier-like dog who shivers and shakes with his master while in a shop. This got middle Britain, I would imagine, up in arms, and 750 people complained that they thought their dog must have been maltreated to have done that in a TV ad. But it seems that the biggest ads to offend Britain are animals and kids, I think.
Mark Sweeney there, he hated Kerry Katona and Iceland, but you, Emily,
my favourite. How could he say that? I just think that never has a brand understood its audience and expressed its brand so well as with our Kerry, with those enormous plates of beige food feeding breadcrumbed prawns to Christopher Biggins.
And even,
what's not to like?
I know. And even after that, notable appearance on This Morning.
I think even after she was a little bit, she'd had a few too many
prawn crackers
and mini Kievs. even after that, they stuck by her, I think. And now she's in brilliant shape. She's got a personal trainer. She's maybe not spending so much time in the lavies. And she's and she's a marvellous ambassadress exactly, for the ticket, for chicken ticker picket,
right.
Pizza slices.
Excellent. One more sector to go in our roundup. You like this one too, Emily. Here's Jemima Kish. It's all about the interweb.
Oh, lovely.
Yes, Google probably cementing their position as, arguably the most important company in increasingly every sector. I mean, you look at what Google, look at the pies in which Google has its fingers. It's quite fascinating. Mobile was arguably the one that it didn't really have a play in until this year. The other thing was operating systems, which doesn't sound like the sexiest thing in the world, but think about what you use on your computer every day. It's one of the most important pieces of software that you use to go onto the internet. And Google launched Chrome in September, which is a very, very sophisticated browser that's fast and stable. And now they'll be able to watch everything you're doing.
As we arrive at iPhone's first birthday, we're gonna take it to the next level. And today we're introducing the iPhone 3G.
iPhone has been out for probably 18 months now. This year it was joined by the first phone from the Google school, a much anticipation about this handset. Google haven't built the actual handset. What Google have done very, very cleverly is built the operating system called Android. So there's going to be loads of Google phones all with the same operating system. But what they've done is make it much more webby. So it's much easier to use email, web browser, Google Docs, Maps in particular, which is a hugely useful thing and one of the most popular things on the iPhone as well, as well as taking the internet or the mobile web to a mainstream audience. They offer a development platform for developers, which means that external companies can build apps quite simply to sit on the phone, which means you have a way of taking your website or service and making it available for people on their phones, which is incredibly powerful.
Yahoo? Wait.
What?
How did you learn how to talk?
Yahoo.
Well, what didn't go on with Yahoo in 2008? There was the re-emergence of what had been a very quiet whisper from the year before in February, when suddenly Microsoft made an unsolicited offer of, I think, $44.6 billion at the time for Yahoo. Microsoft doesn't really have a very sexy image in the Valley, and Yahoo being this, not exactly an anarchic company, but they have a very laid-back, very Silicon Valley cool kind of image. And you very much got the impression that Jerry Yang was not interested. Over a few months, the deal fell apart. We saw Carl Icahn, the sort of corporate raider, come in and try and bully the board into accepting the deal to make a bit of quick cash, as he does. Even that didn't work either, and it's been dragging on and on and on. Now Yahoo's making nearly 2,000 people redundant. They're chopping off really interesting bits of their business, like Brickhouse, which is for interesting startup projects. And you kind of wonder what they're doing, really. They might end up just selling the search bit of their business to Microsoft.
The internet, what's it, seems to be catching on, Emily.
Yes, I know. Some of us have been plugging away about this for years. It's the future, you know. Yes.
Well, it's the present now.
It has been the year of the internet, but then every year will be the year of the internet.
The difference this year is that finally people have started to make money out of it.
Well, I think that people have made money out of it before, actually, but it's just not been kind of the right, not been insufficient amounts for people to really take notice. But yeah, you know, we've now gone from, you know, the internet will never catch on, there is no business model, to I noticed in the States, you know, lawyers are being hired to look at Google's dominance of the ad market, things like that, that actually this is all kind of speeded up. We're all on Facebook now.
I was going to say, it has been compulsory for every newspaper to run at least one Facebook story a day.
Can we just say that
we started this.
This is our fault. Everybody runs a Facebook story a day. Everyone's a Google story
can't move
a day.
There was John Humphreys talking about social networking on the Today programme the other week.
Profoundly uncomfortable. It's not nice, is it?
Predictions for next year. What's going to happen to Yahoo?
We're doomed. Predictions for next year. What's going to happen to Yahoo? Yahoo will be sold, probably to Microsoft, now that they've sorted out their ad clashes. So that's my prediction, first off. Yahoo back on the block will be bought by Microsoft. Who cares?
I was going to say,
Microsoft will probably be, you know, a resurgent company, interestingly.
All right, very good. Thank you very much for that. And anything else you'd like to say about 2009 before we go?
We're doomed. I think if you can hibernate, if you are a tortoise, now is a good time to do it, and don't wake up until 2011.
See you in 2011, then. That's it for our look back on 2008. If you want to agree or disagree with anything that either I, Emily, or one of the other media guardianistas has said, post your comments on the blog or the Facebook wall, guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, or search for Media Guardian on Facebook. My thanks, as always, to Emily Bell for pretending it's been Boxing Day. The mince pies were lovely.
Oh, they are, yes. Indeed.
Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. There's more Media Talk in 2009. Until then, have a very happy new year.